You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a cycle of six lectures by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Spiritual Life Now and After Death, Collected Works, Volume 157A, translated by Pauline Verla and Joanna Collis. This is the last lecture in this series, Lecture 6. I will mention after this that there is a translation of the Dream Song of Olaf Ástason, but I am not going to read that. And so this sixth lecture is entitled Today's Spiritual Darkness, given on the December 21st, 1915. We shall begin today by studying a northern poem that we considered in this group some time ago. The whole content of this poem is connected with Christmas and the Christmas season. It treats the legend of Olaf Ástason and contains the fact that this legendary person passed the 13 days between Christmas and the Day of Epiphany in a very unusual way. And we are reminded thereby how, within the world of these sagas, there lives the perception of the primitive clairvoyance formerly existing in humanity. The story is as follows. Olaf Ástason reaches a church door one Christmas Eve and falls into a sort of sleep-like condition. During the 13 nights, he experiences the secrets of the spiritual world. He experiences them in his own way, as a simple primitive child of nature. We know that during these days, when in a sense the deepest outer darkness prevails over the earth, when the growth of vegetation is at its lowest ebb, when, in a sense, everything external in physical earthly life is at a standstill, the earthly soul awakes and attains its fullest waking consciousness. Now, if a human soul mingles its spiritual nature with what the spirit of the earth then experiences, it can, if it still retains the primitive conditions of nature, rise to a vision of the spiritual world, such as humanity as a whole must gradually reacquire through its own efforts. We then see how this Olaf Ástason actually experiences what we are able to bring from out of the spiritual world. It is not important whether he says Bruksvallen and we say Kamaloka, or soul or spiritual world, or whether we use different images from those in the saga. The important thing is that we perceive how humanity has proceeded in its soul evolution from an original primitive clairvoyance, from a state of union with the spiritual world, and that this had to be lost so that human beings could acquire that thinking, that conscious standing in the world through which they had to pass, and from and beyond which they must again develop a higher perception of the spiritual world. I might say that this spiritual world that the primitive clairvoyance has forsaken is the same in which the evolved perception again lives. But human beings have passed through a condition that now causes them to find their way into this spiritual world in a different way. It is important to develop the feeling that in reality the inner spiritual psychic development of a spiritual psychic being is connected with the transformation of the earth at the different seasons of the year. A psychic spiritual being is connected with the earth, as are human souls, with their physical being. And anyone who merely regards the earth as the geologists do, as the usual natural science of today in its materialistic attitude so easily explains, knows as much of this earth as one person knows of another, of whom he or she is given a model in papier-mâché, and which is not filled with all that the soul pours into the external nature of humanity. External science really only gives us a mere papier-mâché image of the earth. And those who cannot become conscious that a psychic distinction prevails between the winter and summer conditions of the earth are like one who sees no difference between waking and sleeping. Those great beings of nature in whom we live undergo states of spiritual transformations, as do humans themselves, as they are a microcosmic copy of the great macrocosm. Nature and the experiencing of it, the spiritual living with it, has certain significance. Those who can evoke a consciousness that just during these 13 nights something transpires in the soul of the earth that human beings can also experience, will have found one of the ways through which we can live more and more into the spiritual world. The feeling for this experience of what is lived through in the great cosmic existence has been lost to humanity today. We hardly know any more of the difference between winter and summer than that in winter the lamps must be lit earlier, and that it is cold in winter and warm in summer. In earlier times, humanity really lived together with nature, and expressed this by relating in pictorial fashion how beings traversed the land while the snow fell, and passed through the country when the storm raged. But of this, in its deepest sense, the present-day materialistic minds of human beings understand nothing. Yet people may grow into this frame of mind again, in the deepest sense, if they turn to what the old sagas still relate, especially in as profound a myth as that of Olaf Asteson, which shows in such a beautiful way how a simple primitive man, while losing his physical consciousness, grows into the clear light of spiritual vision. We shall now bring this saga before our souls, this saga that belongs to bygone centuries, which has been lost and has now been recorded again from the folk memories. It is one of the most beautiful of the northern sagas, for it speaks in a wonderful way of profound cosmic mysteries, insofar as the union of the human soul with the world soul is a cosmic mystery. As we are able to meet here today, we may perhaps speak of a few things that may be useful to some of us when we look back to what we have learned through spiritual science in the course of the year. We know, and this has lately been emphasized even in our public lectures, that at the back of what is visible to external perception as the outer human being, there lies a spiritual kernel of our being, that is, in a sense, composed of two members. We have learned to know the one as what meets our spiritual vision upon undergoing the experience usually designated as the approach to the gate of death. The other member of the inner life appears before the human soul when we become aware that in all the experiences of our will, there is an inner spectator, an onlooker, who is always present. Thus we can say that human thought, if we deepen it through meditation, shows us that within us there is always present in the innermost of our spiritual being a something that in relation to the outer physical body works to destroy the human organism, ending in death. We know from the considerations already presented that the actual force used in thinking is not constructive, but in a sense destructive. Through our power of dying, through developing our organism in our life between birth and death so that it can fall into decay and dissipate into the cosmic elements, we are enabled to create the organ by means of which we develop thought, the noblest flower of physical human existence. But in the depths of human life, between birth and death, is a kind of life seed for the future that is adapted especially to progress through the gates of death. It is what develops in the currents of will, and that can be regarded as the spectator already characterized. It must continually be urged that what brings spiritual vision to the soul of humanity is not something that first develops through the spiritual vision itself, but something that is always present. It is always there. Only human beings in our present epoch should not see it. This may be said, that one ought not to see it. The evolution of the spiritual life has made much progress, especially in recent decades, so that all who really give themselves up to what in our materialistic age is designated the spiritual life, spread a veil over what lives in their inner nature. In our present age, those concepts and ideas are chiefly developed that are best calculated to conceal what is present spiritually in humanity. In order to strengthen ourselves aright for our special task, we who follow spiritual science may point just at this significant season to the particularly dark side of present-day spiritual life, which must indeed exist, just as the darkness in external nature must also exist. But that we must perceive, and of the existence of which we must become aware. We are living through a somewhat dark period of civilization in regard to the spiritual life. We need not constantly repeat that in no wise do we undervalue the enormous conquests of which in this epoch of darkness humankind is so proud. Nevertheless, with regard to spiritual things, the fact remains that those concepts and ideas that are created in our epoch absolutely conceal what lives in the souls of human beings, especially from those who immerse themselves most earnestly in these ideas. In reference to this, the following may be mentioned. Our epoch is especially proud of its clear thinking, acquired through its important scientific training. Our age is very proud of itself. Of course, not so proud as to lead all people to want to think a great deal. No, its pride does not lead to that. But it results in this, that people say, quote, in our epoch we must think a great deal if we want to know anything of the spiritual world, close quote. To do the necessary thinking oneself is very difficult, but that is the task of the theologians. They can ruminate on these things. Thus our epoch is supposed to be highly evolved and is exalted above the dark age of belief in authority. So we must listen to the theologians who are able to think about spiritual things. Our epoch has also progressed with respect to the concept of right and wrong, of good and evil. Our epoch is the epoch of thought. But in spite of this advance from the belief in authority, it has not led each person to think more deeply on right and wrong. The lawyers do that. Therefore, because we have got beyond the epoch of belief in authority, we must leave it to the enlightened lawyers to think over what is good and evil, right or wrong. And with reference to bodily conditions, to bodily cures, because we do not know what is healthy or unhealthy in this epoch that desires to be so free from belief in authority, we go to the doctors. This could be exemplified in all domains. Our epoch is not much inclined to despair, as was Faust, quote, I have studied, alas, philosophy and jurisprudence and medicine too, and, saddest of all, theology, with ardent labor through and through, and here I stick as wise poor fool, as when my steps first turned to school. Close quote. One thing results. Our age actually refuses to know anything of the things that perplexed Faust, but desires to know all the more of those things already clearly cognized in the many different departments in which the weal and woe of humanity are decided. Our epoch is so terribly proud of its thinking that those who have brought themselves to read a little philosophy in the course of their lives, I will not go so far as to say they have read Kant, but merely some commentary on Kant, are now persuaded that anyone who asserts anything about the spiritual world in the sense of spiritual science sins against the undeniable facts established by Kant. It has often been said that the whole work of the 19th century has been directed to developing human thought and investigating it by means of critical knowledge. And many today call themselves critical thinkers who have only taken in a little. Many people today, for instance, assert that humanity's knowledge is limited, for they perceive the outer world through their senses, yet these senses can merely yield what they produce through themselves. Thus people perceive the world by its effects on their senses. Therefore they cannot get behind the things of the world, for they can never transcend the limit of their senses. They can only receive pictures of reality. And many, speaking from the depths of their philosophy, say, the human soul has only pictures of the world, thus it can never arrive at the thing in itself. One may thus compare what we obtain through our senses, our eyes, ears, and so on, to pictures in a mirror. Certainly, if a mirror is there and throws back pictures, the image of one person, the image of a second person, and so on, and we observe them, we then have a world of images. Then come the philosophers who say, just as any who see a person or two in a mirror's reflected image have a picture world of their own, and as they do not behold the thing in itself, the person, but merely the person's image, similarly, we really have only images of the whole outer world, as the rays of light and color strike the eye or as waves of air strike our ear. We have only images. All are images. The result in our critical time is that human beings form nothing but images in their souls and can never reach to the thing in itself through these images. Infinite wisdom, I now speak in full earnestness, has been applied by philosophy in the 19th century to prove that humanity merely has images and can never reach the thing in itself. What is the real origin of this critical resignation or passivity regarding the so-called limitations of our knowledge when we discover the image nature of our perception? Where does it originate? It arises from the fact that in many ways the thought of our epoch, of our enlightened age, is devoid of truth and short-sighted. Our thinking throws out an idea in a pedantic fashion and cannot get beyond it. It holds up this idea like a wooden mannequin and can no longer find anything that is not given by the mannequin. It is almost incredible how rigid thought has become in our time. I shall just make clear to you, by means of the same comparison of the reflected image, the whole story of this image nature of our perception, and of what the so-called critical progressive thought has produced. It is a correct premise that the world, as we have it here in sensory existence, is only here because it impresses itself on human beings and throws up images in their souls. And it is well that humanity should have reached this point through the critical philosophy of Kant. We are well able to say that our images of the outer world are such that we can compare them to images of the two people in a mirror. Thus we have a mirror, and two people stand before it. We do not see them, but only their images. We have images of the world through what our souls know of the outer world. We have images that we compare with the two people whose reflected pictures we observe, but someone who had never seen people but only images would be able to philosophize, I know nothing of the people but their lifeless images. Thus conclude the critical philosophers. They remain satisfied with this conclusion. They would find themselves refuted in their own being if they could get a little further from their mannequin of thought, away from the dead into the living thought. If I am in front of a mirror in which two people are reflected, and I see that the one strikes the other so that the person is wounded, I would be a fool to say that one mirror image has struck the other. I no longer see only the mirror image, but real events through the image. I have only the image, but I see an absolutely real event through the mirror image. I would be a fool to believe that this occurred only in the mirror. Thus, critical philosophy seizes the one thought that we have to deal with images, but not the other thought, that the images express the facts of something alive. If we comprehend the images in a living way, they give more than pictures, for they point to the thing in itself, which is the real outer world. Can we still say that those who produce this critical philosophy really think? To a great extent, thought is lacking today. It is really at a standstill. And we have stood still at this criticism of thought. I have often mentioned that this criticism, this critical philosophy, has even progressed in our culture, and that a person making a noble effort, they are all honorable people and their efforts entirely praiseworthy, has produced a certain critique of language. Fritz Mautner has written titled Contributions to a Critique of Language in 3 thick volumes, and even a philosophical dictionary written from this perspective in 2 even thicker volumes. Mautner himself, a journalist, has a whole journalistic train of followers who naturally regard it as a great work. And in our time, in which belief in authority is supposed to be unimportant, many who have reached that perspective consider it a significant work, as does even the press, for which Fritz Mautner wrote today, quote, "No belief in authority exists," close quote. Now Mautner finally explains how humanity actually forms nouns, adjectives, etc., but says they all signify nothing real. In the outer world, one does not experience what words signify. Human beings so live themselves into words that we really do not have thoughts and soul images, but merely words, words, words. People find themselves entangled in the language that gives them their vocabulary. And because they are accustomed to attaching themselves to the language, they only reach the symbol of things as given in words. Now, that is supposed to be something very significant. And if one reads these 3 volumes by Mautner, and if you have something to reproach yourself with, it is a good penance to read half of them. Then one finds that their author is profoundly convinced, indeed one cannot put it otherwise, that he is cleverer than all the clever people of his time. Of course, people who judge their own book are naturally cleverer than the others. So Fritz Mautner finally concludes that people have nothing but signs, signs, signs. Indeed, he goes even further. He goes so far as to say that people have eyes, ears, sense of touch, and so on, that is, a collection of sense organs. In addition, Mautner believes that human beings might have not only organs of sight, hearing, touch, and taste, but quite different senses. For instance, people might have another sense besides the eye, EYE. With this sense, they would perceive the world quite differently from how they do by receiving pictures through the eyes. Thus, much would exist for them that is not perceptible to the ordinary person. Now, this critical thinker feels a little mystically inclined and says that the immeasurable fullness of the world is conveyed to us only through our senses. Moreover, he calls these accidental senses, because he believes it is a cosmic accident that we should have just these very senses. If we had other senses, the world would appear differently. Thus, it is best to say that we have accidental senses, thus an accidental world. Yet he says the world is immeasurable. This sounds beautiful. One of Fritz Mautner's followers wrote a pamphlet titled Skepticism and Mysticism. In it, special attention is drawn to the fact that human beings may even become mystics in the depths of their souls when they no longer believe what these accidental senses can offer. A beautiful sentence is given us on the 12th page of this book, quote, "The world pours down on us. Through the few miserable openings of our accidental senses, we take in what we can grasp and fasten it to our old vocabulary, since we have nothing else to retain it with. But the world streams further. Our language also streams on further, only not in the same direction, but according to the accident of language, which is subject to no laws." Close quote. Another philosophy. What does it want to do? It says that the world is immeasurable, but that we have only a few accidental senses into which the world flows. What do we do with what flows in? What do we do according to this gentleman's doctrine of accidents? We remind ourselves of what he calls memory. We fasten that onto the words transmitted to us through our language, and the language then flows on again. Thus we speak in our word symbols about what flows to us from the immeasurable cosmic being through our accidental senses. A sage thought, I repeat it in all earnestness, it is a wise thought. One must be a smart person in our age to think in this way. It can really be said of such people that not only are they honorable and praiseworthy, but they are also remarkable thinkers. But they are entangled in the thought of our age and lack the will to transcend it. I have experienced a kind of Christmas sadness, one cannot call it joy, for it has become grief, through having once more to consider certain of these matters in this connection. And I have written down a thought, formed exactly after the style of the above thinker who wrote what has just been read. I have applied exactly the same thought to another object with the following results. Quote, Goethe's genius is poured onto the paper. With the few miserable forms of its accidental letters, the paper takes up what it can, and lets itself express what it can take up with its old store of letters, since there is nothing else to express it with. But Goethe's genius streams on further. The writing on the paper also streams on further, not only in the same direction, but according to the accidents in which letters can group themselves, being subject to no laws. Close quote. It is exactly the same thought, and due regard has been given to each single word. If one maintains that, quote, the immeasurable cosmos pours down to us, and we take it up with our few accidental senses as well as we are able, and fix it into our vocabulary, the cosmos then streams on further, while language streams in another direction according to the accidents of the history of language, and thus human perception flows on. Close quote. Then this is exactly the same thought, as if one said, quote, Goethe's genius flows through the 23 accidental letters, because the paper can only receive things in that way. But Goethe's genius is never within them, for it is immeasurable. The accidental letters cannot take that up. They stream on further. What is on the paper also streams on further and groups itself according to the formations possible to the letters, the laws of which cannot be perceived. Close quote. If now these very smart gentlemen conclude from such suppositions that what comes to us in the world is merely the result of accidental senses, that we can never get to what really underlies the world in its depths, that is the same as thinking that in reality one can never reach what lived in the genius of Goethe. For they make it clear that of this genius nothing exists but the grouping of 23 accidental letters. Nothing else is there. These people have a precisely similar thought, only they are not aware of it. And there is just as much sense in saying, quote, one can never know anything at all of Goethe's genius, for you see that nothing of it can flow to you. You can have nothing but what the different grouping of 23 accidental signs can give. Close quote. There is just as much sense in this as in the discussion on the cosmos that these people bring forth concerning the possibility or impossibility of cosmic knowledge. There is just as much sense in this whole train of thought, which is not the thinking of simpletons, but the thinking of those who are really the clever people of today, but who do not wish to raise themselves above the thought of our epoch. The matter has, however, really another aspect. We must be clear that this manner of thinking, which meets us in the example in which it determines the limitations of knowledge, is our own mode of thought in the present age. It prevails and is to be found everywhere today. And whether you read this or that apparently philosophical book, intended to solve the great mysteries of the universe or disguise them, or whether you read the newspaper, this style of thinking is everywhere prevalent. Its methods dominate the world. we drink it in today with our morning coffee. More and more daily journals appear with such opinions. And in the whole web of our social life, this same manner of thought prevails. I have attempted to expose this thinking in its philosophical development, but it could also be traced in those thoughts that one evolves in every possible relation in life, in everything people reflect upon. This thinking prevails today. And this is the cause of people's inability to evolve the will to experience in its reality what, for example, spiritual science seeks to give. Spiritual science is not incomprehensible to true thinking, but what it has to give must naturally always remain incomprehensible to those who are built after the pattern of Fritz Mautner. And the majority of people are fashioned thus today. Our contemporary science is absolutely permeated through and through with this thinking. Nothing is here implied against the significance and the great achievements of science. That is not the point. The essential question is how the soul lives in our age, in our present civilization. Our age is utterly lacking in the power of fluidic thought, unable really to follow what must be followed, if these thoughts are to grasp what spiritual science has to impart. Now we can ask ourselves this, quote, how does it happen that such a book as Gustav Landauer's, titled Skepticism and Mysticism, can be written, since it simply oozes with self-satisfaction? Close quote. I might say that the readers themselves beam with its whole tone of self-satisfaction, as they do when reading Mautner's title Criticism of Language, or the article in the title Philosophical Dictionary. How is this? One does not learn how this comes about by following the thinking. I can imagine very clever people reading such a book and saying that this is a very smart person. They would be right, for Mautner is indeed smart. That, however, is not the point. Cleverness expresses itself by people forming with a certain logic the ideas they are able to formulate, turning them one after the other into nonsense, and reconstructing them again in some way. One may be very clever in some branch or other, and possess a really right sort of cleverness. But if one enters a life that is permeated with the consciousness of spiritual knowledge, then with each step there develops such a relation to the world that one has the feeling, quote, you must go further and further. You must perfect your ideas each day. You must develop the belief that your ideas can lead you further and further. Close quote. One has the feeling that the cleverness of people who have written such a book are of the following nature, quote, I am clever, and through my cleverness I have accomplished something definite. I will now write that in a book. What I now am I shall inscribe in a book, for I am clever on this December 21st, 1915. The book must be finished, and will reproduce my cleverness. Close quote. Those who really know never have that feeling. They have the feeling of a continual evolution, of an eternal necessity to refine one's ideas and to evolve higher. And they certainly no longer have the feeling, quote, on this December 21st, 1915, I am clever. Now, through my cleverness, I shall write a book that will be finished in the course of months or years. Close quote. For if they have written a book, they truly do not look back to the cleverness that they had when they began to write it. But through the book they acquire the feeling, quote, how little I have really accomplished in the matter, and how necessary it is for me to evolve further what I have written. Close quote. This, quote, journeying along the path of knowledge, close quote, this constant inner labor is almost entirely unknown to our materialistic age. It believes it knows it, but in reality it knows it no longer. And the deepest reason for this can be clothed in the words, quote, these people are so excessively vain, close quote. People are tremendously vain, for as I said, such a book really oozes with vanity. It is clever, but terribly vain. The humility, the modesty that results from such a path of knowledge has been laid down, is utterly lacking to these people. It must be utterly lacking when people unconditionally ascribe cleverness to themselves on this December 21st, 1915. Humility must be lacking. Now you will say, quote, these people must be stupid if they regard themselves as clever, close quote. But they do not consider themselves stupid with the surface consciousness, but with the subconscious. They never learn to distinguish between the truth that lives in the subconscious and what they ascribe to themselves on the surface. And thus it is the luciferic nature that really urges people of today to desire to be clever, to attain a definite perspective of cleverness, and from this point to consider and judge everything. However, when people bear this luciferic nature within themselves, then, while they behold the external world with Lucifer, they are led to Ahriman. They then naturally see this outer world materialistically in our epoch. Quite naturally they look at it in a materialistic way. For when people with Lucifer in their nature begin to contemplate the world, they then meet Ahriman. For these two seek each other out in human intercourse with this world. Therefore such radically vain thinking never reaches the possibility of this conviction, quote, if I use a word, I naturally use merely a symbol for what the word signifies, close quote. Mautner made the great discovery that no substantives exist. There are none. They are no reality. Of course not. We grasp certain phenomena, think of them rightly for a moment, and call them substantives. Certainly substantives are not reality. Neither are adjectives. That is quite understood. That is all true. But now if I join a substantive and an adjective together, if I bring speech into movement, it then expresses reality. Then what the image represents transcends the image. Single words are no reality in themselves. We do not, however, speak in single words, but in groups of words. And in these we have an immediate presence within the reality. 3 volumes have to be written today and a 2-volume dictionary added in order to expound all these things to people by means of thoughts of infinite cleverness, which simply overlook the fact that although single words are only symbols, the connecting of several into groups is nevertheless not merely symbolical, but forms part of the reality. Infinite wisdom, infinite cleverness, is today used to prove the greatest errors. Now, finally, that such errors should be manifest in a criticism of speech, or even in a criticism of thought, is not in itself so bad. But the same kind of thought expressed in these errors, in these very intelligent and clever mistakes, live in the whole thought of our present-day humanity. If we do but grasp the task that is comprised in our spiritual movement, it really forms part of it that we should become conscious of the necessity for those who wish to be spiritual scientists to look at their era in the right way and really place themselves in the right attitude to it. So that really I might say that the practical side of our spiritually scientific movement demands that we seek to transcend the thinking that answers to the preceding description, and that we do not follow along such lines of thought, but try to change them. We will immediately approach an understanding of spiritual science with the simplicity of children, if we only remove the hindrances that have entered the spiritual life of the civilization of our present time through stiffened and petrified forms of thought. Everywhere we should lay aside in our own souls the belief in authority that today appears under the mask of freedom. This should form part of the practical life of our spiritual science. And it will become increasingly necessary that there should be at least a few who truly see the facts as they are and as they have been described today. And not just see them, but also take them in real earnestness all through life. This is the essential. We need not display this externally, but much can be done if only a small number of individuals will organize their lives, in whatever position they may occupy, in accordance with these explanations. We can see in one definite respect how absolutely our age demands that we should again make our thinking alive. Let us briefly place before our souls something that we have often considered. In the beginning of our era, that being whom we have frequently characterized, the Christ being, took on the life of a human being and united himself with the earth's aura. Through this, there was given to the earth, for the first time, the right purpose for its further evolution, after it had been lost through the Luciferic temptation. The event of Golgotha took place. The evangelists, who were seers, though for the most part seers in the old style, have described this event. Paul also described this mystery of Golgotha. Paul saw the Christ spiritually through the event of Damascus. His clairvoyance was different from that of the evangelists. As a result of these descriptions, a number of people united their souls with the Christ event. Through this connection of single individuals with the Christ event, Christianity was spread abroad. At first it lived underground, so that in reality the following picture may continually appear in our souls. In ancient Rome, underground, those who had grasped the mystery of Golgotha with their souls maintained their divine service. Above, the civilization and culture of the age, then at its summit, carried on. Several centuries passed, what was formerly carried on below in the catacombs, concealed and despised, now fills the world. And the civilization of that time, the old Roman intellectual culture, has disappeared. Christianity is spread abroad. But now the time has come when people have begun to think, when they have become clever and free from authority. Thinkers have appeared who have examined the evangelists, honorable and clever thinkers. They are all worthy of honor. They have concluded that there is no historical testimony in the Gospels. They have studied them for decades with earnest and critical labor. And they have come to the conclusion that there is no actual historical testimony in the Gospels, that Christ Jesus never lived at all. Nothing is to be said against this critical labor. It is industrious. Whoever knows it knows of its industry and of its cleverness. There is no reason to despise lightly this critical wisdom. But what does it imply? What is at the bottom of it all? This: that humanity does not in the least see the point of importance. Christ Jesus did not intend to make things so easy for people that subsequent historians should arise and comfortably verify his existence on the earth as simply and easily as the existence of Frederick the Great may be verified. Christ did not wish to make things as easy as that for people, nor even would it have been right for him to do so. As true as is the fact that this critical labor on the Gospels is clever and industrious, so it is also true that the existence of Christ may never be proved in that way, for that would be materialistic proof. In everything that people can prove in external fashion, Ahriman plays a part. But Ahriman may never meddle with the proof as to Christ. Therefore, there exists no historical proof. Humanity will have to recognize this. Although Christ lived on the earth, yet he must be found through inner recognition, not through historical documents. The Christ event must come to humanity in a spiritual manner, and therefore no materialistic investigations of truth, nothing materialistic, may intervene in this. The most important event of the earthly evolution can never be proved in a materialistic manner. It is as if, through cosmic history, humanity were told, "Your materialistic proofs, what you still desire above all in your materialistic age is only of value for what exists in the field of matter. For the spiritual, you should not and may not have materialistic proof. Thus, those may even be right who destroy the old historical documents. Just in reference to the Christ event, it must be understood that in our epoch, that one can only come to the Christ in a spiritual way. He will never truly be found by external methods. We may be told that Christ exists, but to find him really is only possible in a spiritual manner. It is important to consider that in the Christ event, we have an occurrence concerning which all who will not admit spiritual knowledge must live in error. It is extraordinary that certain people go wild when one utters what I have just said, that the Christ can be known by spiritual means. Thus, what is historical can be recognized spiritually. Certain people affirm that it is really not possible. No matter who says it, it cannot be true. I have repeatedly drawn your attention to this fact. Now, our worthy anthroposophic members still let many things leak out here and there in unsuitable places, because they do not always retain this in their hearts, nor give forth in the right way what they have in their hearts. For instance, a person was told this reached him in a special form. This is certainly a personal remark, but perhaps I may make it this once. He was told that I had said that personally, as regards my youthful development, I did not begin with the Bible, but started from natural science, and that I considered it as of special importance that I had adopted this spiritual path, and had been really convinced of the inner truth of what stands in the Bible before I had ever read it. For I was then certain of it when I had read the Bible externally. That I had thus proved in myself that the contents of the Bible can be found in a spiritual manner, before finding it subsequently in an external manner. This has no value because of its personal character, but it may serve as an illustration. Now, that came in an unseemly way to a man who could not understand that anything of the sort is possible, for he is, pardon the word, a theologian. He could not understand it. Since he wanted to make this matter clear in a lecture to his audience, he did so in the following way. He read in a book that I once assisted at Mass. These assistants are boys who give external help at the Mass. Then he said to himself, quote, "Whoever assisted at Mass cannot possibly have been ignorant of the Bible. He overlooks the fact that he learned to know the Bible there. Later on, these things come back to him from his Bible knowledge." Close quote. Yes, but there is indeed a plan in all this. In the first place, the whole story is untrue. But people today do not object to quoting a fact that is untrue. In the second place, the assistants at Mass never learn the Bible, but the Mass book, which has nothing to do with the Bible. But the essential is to attend to this. The man could not conceive that a spiritual relation exists. He could only imagine that one comes through the letters of the alphabet to the spiritual hanging on to them. It is very important for us to know these things and to have practical knowledge of them. For our spiritual movement will never be able to thrive until we really, not merely externally, but in the very depths of our soul, find the courage to enter into everything connected with the whole meaning and significance of our conception of the world. And with reference to this uniting oneself with the spiritual world, a critical situation has really arisen just in our time. The very people who regard themselves as the most enlightened feel themselves least united with the spiritual world. This is not stated as a reproach or criticism, but as a fact. It is therefore especially important in our time to arouse an inner understanding for such significant cosmic symbols as meet us in everything that surrounds the mystery of Christmas. For this can unite itself very deeply with a person's nature, without the help of letters or learning. We must be able to make the Christmas mystery alive in every situation in life, particularly in our own soul. When we awaken this mystery in our souls, we look up and say, quote, "Christmas reminds us of the descent of Christ Jesus onto the earthly plane, and of the rebirth of that in humanity that was lost to him through the Luciferic temptation." Close quote. This rebirth occurs in different stages. One stage is that within which we ourselves stand. What, for the sake of further evolution, had to be lost, the feeling in the human heart of union with the spiritual world, the birth of Christ within us, is only another word for it. That has to be born again. Just that, which we desire and ever strive for, is intimately connected with this Christmas mystery. And we should not merely regard this Christmas mystery as that day of the year on which we fix up our Christmas tree, and beholding it take into ourselves all sorts of edification, but we should look upon it as something present in our whole existence, appearing to us in all that surrounds us. As a symbol, I should like in conclusion to present something that a remarkable poet, who died many years ago, wrote of his feeling about Christmas. Quote, "Our church celebrates various festivals that penetrate our hearts. One can hardly conceive anything one can love more than Pentecost, or is more earnest and holy than Easter. The sadness and melancholy of Passion Week and the solemnity of that Sunday accompany us through life. The church celebrates one of the most beautiful festivals, the festival of Christmas, almost in midwinter, during the longest nights and shortest days, when the sun shines obliquely across our land and snow covers the plains. As in many countries, the day before the festival of the birth of our Lord is called the Christmas Eve, with us it is called the Holy Evening. The following day is the Holy Day, and the night intervening, the Sacred Eve. The Catholic Church celebrates Christmas Day, the day of the birth of the Savior, with the greatest solemnity. In most regions, the hour of midnight is sacred to the hour of the birth of the Lord, and kept with impressive nocturnal solemnity, to which the bells call one through the quiet, solemn air of the dark midwinter night, and to which the inhabitants go, with lanterns along the well-known paths, from the snow mountains and through the bare forests, hurrying through the orchards to the church, which with its lighted windows dominates the wooded village with the peasants' houses." Close quote from Adalbert Stifter, Bergkristall. Steiner again. He then describes what the Christ festival is to the children, and further, how in the old and isolated village there lived a cobbler who took a wife out of the neighboring village, not out of his own. How the children of this couple learned to know Christmas as was customary there. That is, someone said to them, quote, "The Holy Christ has brought you this gift," close quote. And when they were sufficiently tired of the presents, they were put to bed, very tired, and did not hear the midnight bells. These children had thus never yet heard the midnight bells. Now they often visited the neighboring village. As they grew up and were able to go out alone, they visited their grandmother there. The grandmother was especially fond of the children, as is often the case. Grandparents are often more devoted to the children than the parents. The grandmother liked to have the children with her, as she was too frail to go out. One Christmas Eve, which promised to be fine, the children were sent over to their grandmother. The children went over in the morning, and were to return in the afternoon to follow the custom of the country, calling at the different villages, and were then to find the Christmas tree at home in the evening. But the day turned out different from what was expected. The children were overtaken by a terrible snowstorm. They wandered over the mountains, lost their way, and in the midst of a dreadful snowstorm they reached a trackless country. What the children went through is very beautifully described, how during the night they saw a phenomenon of nature. It is desirable to read you the passage, for one cannot relate it as beautifully as it is described there. Each word is really important. They reached an ice field on a glacier. they heard behind them the crackling of the glacier in the night. You may imagine what an impression that makes on the children. The story continues. Even before their very eyes, something began to develop. As the children sat thus, a pale light blossomed in the sky, in the center, underneath the stars, and formed a delicate arch through them. It had a greenish shimmer that moved gently downward. But the arch became clearer and clearer until the stars withdrew and faded away from it. It even sent a reflection into other regions of the sky, a pale green light, which moved and coated gently among the stars. Then arose sheaves of various lights from the arch, like the spikes of a crown, and they flamed. The neighboring spaces of the heavens were flooded with light, gently scintillating and traversing long stretches of the heavens in delicate quivering. Had, quote, the storm substance, close quote, of the sky so expanded through the snowfall that it flowed out in these silent, glorious streams of light? Or was it some other cause in unfathomable nature? Gradually the whole became fainter and fainter, the sheaves becoming extinguished first until slowly and imperceptibly it all became fainter, and nothing remained in the sky but the hosts of simple stars. The children sat thus through the night. They heard nothing of the bells beneath. They had only snow and ice around them in the mountains and the stars and the phenomena of the night above them. The night drew to a close. People grew anxious about them. The whole village set out to find them. They were found and brought home. I can omit the rest and merely say that the children were almost stiff with cold, were put to bed, and told that they should receive their Christmas gifts later. The mother went to the children, which is related in this way. The children were confused by all this agitation. They had been given something to eat and were put to bed. Toward evening, when they recovered a little, while certain neighbors and friends gathered in the sitting room and spoke of the event, the mother went into the bedroom and sat on Sana's bed, caressing her. Then the little maid said, "Mother, while I sat on the mountain tonight, I saw the Holy Christ." Close quote, close whole quote. This is a beautiful presentation. The children had grown up without any instruction about the Christmas festival. They had to pass Christmas Eve in that terrible situation, up above on the mountains, amid snow and ice, with only the stars above them, and this phenomenon of nature. They were discovered, brought back to the house, and the little maid said, "Mother, I have seen the Holy Christ tonight. I have seen the Holy Christ. Seen him." She had seen him, so she said. There lies a deeper meaning in this when it is said, as we have always emphasized in our spiritual science, that Christ is not to be found only where we find him. In the evolution of the earth epoch, historically inserted into the beginning of our era where civilization shows him to us. But he is also to be found everywhere, especially when we are confronted with the world at the most serious moments of our life. We can surely find the Christ then, and we ourselves, we spiritual disciples, as I might say, can find him if only we are sufficiently persuaded that all our efforts must be directed to the rebirth of the spiritual in the development of humankind, and that this spiritual, which must be born through a special activity of the souls and hearts of human beings, is based on the foundation of what was born into the earth's evolution through the mystery of Golgotha. That is something that we must realize at this season. If you can find during the days of which we have spoken today, and that are now approaching, a correct inner feeling of the evolving and weaving of outer earthly existence in its similarity with the sleeping and waking of humanity, if you can experience a deeper communion with external events, you will then feel more and more the truth of the words, "Christ is here." As he himself said, "I am with you always, unto the end of the earth's ages." And Christ can always be found if we only seek him. That thought should strengthen us and invigorate us at this Christmas festival if we celebrate it in this sense. Let us carry away these thoughts that may help us to find what we have to regard as the real content, the real depth of our spiritual scientific efforts. May we bring to our age souls so strengthened that we can place ourselves in the right attitude toward it, as we now desire to do. Thus let us turn from the general consideration we have brought concerning the spiritual world to the feeling of strengthening that can come to us from these considerations, strength for our souls. Now let us turn our attention to those on the fields where the great events of our time are taking place. Quote, "Spirits ever watchful, guardians of their souls, may your vibrations waft to the earth human beings committed to your charge, our souls petitioning love. That united with your power, our prayer may helpfully radiate to the souls it lovingly seeks." Close quote. And for those who, in consequence of these events, have already passed through the gate of death, quote, "Spirits ever watchful, guardians of their souls, may your vibrations waft to those of the spheres committed to your charge, our souls petitioning love. That united with your power, our prayer may helpfully radiate to the souls it lovingly seeks." Close quote. And that spirit whom we are seeking through the deepening of spiritual science, the spirit with whom we desire to unite, who descended onto the earth and passed through earthly death for the salvation of humankind, for the healing, progress, and freedom of the earth, may he be at your side in all your difficult duties. That's the end of Lecture 6 and the end of the book, Spiritual Life Now and After Death, Collected Works, Volume 157A by Rudolf Steiner.